Hey, Whiskey Ringers. I am thrilled to welcome back Impex Beverages as the Whiskey Ring Podcast presenting sponsor. Each month, we'll be talking about a new set of single casks, maybe feature a chosen distillery, or single casks from a chosen distillery. Listen for the mid-roll for more info on this month's offerings. And now, a brand new episode of the Whiskey Ring Podcast. Hey, folks, welcome to a new episode of the Whiskey... I'm going to try that again. Hey, folks, welcome to an episode of the Whiskey Ring Podcast. My guest today is about as far away as you can possibly be from me, which I think he's okay with, but we'll see. So my guest today is Matthew Johns. He is from Pokeno Distillery in New Zealand, the North Island of New Zealand, just a little bit south of Auckland. And I'm pretty sure I can't get farther away from New York City than this in a distillery. So Matt, welcome. You are a full day ahead of me at the as well. So welcome on.
Yeah. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, David. That's great. Yeah, I think there is a direct flight, I think, actually from us to you now, but I think it takes something like 19 hours or something. So.
Oh, God. I did 13 hours to Israel. That was a killer. I can't do this ever again. as I was telling you before we started recording, as a newer distillery, as one that didn't do things like putting out white whiskeys or vodkas or gins before you were ready to produce the whiskeys. Pokeno was just coming on the scene. Yeah. It's a fairly new product to market. So I'm going to get to ask some of the basic questions that usually I have to skip over because you've been asked them 1,000 times. And I'm kind of excited about that. So, you know, let's start with that. Let's start with what is, you know, how did you get to this place, to New Zealand and to Pokeno?
It's a long story. So, I think I'll do that in two parts. Is firstly, how did we get to New Zealand? We've been in New Zealand now for close to 12 years. My brother actually lived in New Zealand for 25 years now, and he was getting married to his Kiwi wife 12 years ago. He said, come over for the wedding. And a bit like you, we went, oh, that's a long way to go. And we said, look, if we're going to go over, we'll go over for kind of 6 months. My wife is French, Celine. And we were living in France at the time. The kids were, I think, 3 and 5 at the time, spoke no English whatsoever because we were speaking French all the time. And we said, it's a great experience. Let's go to New Zealand, put the kids into school, do the 6 months and then come back again. And kind of we never quite made it out. After 5 months, everybody was enjoying it so much. They were going, this is absolutely fantastic. The lifestyle is great. The country is beautiful. Can we stay? And so we kind of took the decision to stay in 2013. And then it was more about, okay, well, if we're going to stay, what are we going to do? And I've been in the whiskey industry for 26 years of my life now. And basically, the only thing I knew how to do was make whiskey. So we kind of went, well, if we're going to stay, why don't we make some whiskey? At the time, there were no distilleries in New Zealand at all. And obviously, New Zealand has these fantastic natural attributes, you know, tall mountains, pure spring water, an incredible climate for maturation. So it seemed kind of an obvious route to go. So that was kind of the basics of how I got to New Zealand, how I decided to stay, and why I decided to make whiskey. I'm sure we'll develop that more in the coming hour.
Absolutely. And just going to that, I was trying to look up a history of distilling in New Zealand, and that there really isn't much. There's this, the Wellington Distillery? Is there? No.
The history of New Zealand, there used to be a distillery called the Wilson's Distillery. That was down in Dunedin in the South Island. That was actually a Seagram distillery, but that was shut in 1992. There was a little bit of stock remaining from that, which was, I think, bought by a private investor. And then it was rebought by a company that set up at the start of this century, the New Zealand Whiskey Collection. And they've been gradually releasing some of that old stock over the last 10 or 15 years in very small batches. But there really was no distillation in New Zealand at all from I'd say 1990 up to about 2012-13, I'm tempted to say. There's a couple of guys who did some distilling. Matt Thompson Whiskies, real cool guy, did some real cool distilling and still does today. And then you've gradually over the last kind of 3 or 4 years had a few distilleries which are starting to pop up. We started our distillery in 2017, We kind of we took a couple of years to build it up. Why Pocono is that? So the North Island, New Zealand is most of your listeners won't know this probably is, but New Zealand is two distinct islands. Everybody thinks it's that tiny speck on the end of the map at the arse end of the world, which we are at the arse end of the world. We always know that, but actually New Zealand's quite big. So for me to drive from the top of the North Island to the top of to the bottom of the North Island would take me 18 hours. Yeah, wow. when we fly from the North Island to the South Island, it's a 2.5 hour flight. So it's not as small as that little speck that people think. And you've got two distinct islands with two distinct different climates. You have the North Island, which is a subtropical island, you know, crazy levels of humidity, palm trees, beaches, cyclones, as you've recently seen, et cetera, and the rest of it. And the South Island, which is very much the Alps. You know, you've got the high mountains, you've got the colder, more temperature, you've got snow, you've got the ski stations in the winter. So it's two completely different different climates. So we've always lived in Auckland, in the North Island. And so we were looking around Auckland to say, okay, within an hour's radius, what would be really cool for making a distillery? And there's a couple of things that drew us to Pocono. The first thing was the water. So Pocono is in a valley just over the Bombay Hills, which is a range of volcanic hills which surround this valley, which is almost below sea level. And we're kind of down in the bottom of this valley. We've got our own water source beneath the distillery, and it's the volcanic water which kind of collects from the hills and drains down into the source below us. So that was the key thing, was the New Zealand pure water, being able to base ourselves there and get access to that fantastic water. It's a water which is really rich in iron and manganese, so great for distilling. And the second thing was for the maturation as well. I mean, you know, we're obviously in a subtropical island, but with the levels we are at in Pocono, in this humid valley, that is accentuated. We're sitting at kind of 95, 96% humidity most of the time down here. So that kind of accelerates the maturation in a crazy way, which I'm sure we'll talk about a bit later on as well.
Oh my God, 95, 90. So you have to, I like the cold. Like the colder, the better. I'm starting AC in like April. I start putting on the AC to pull out the humidity. So the idea of 95 to 96% humidity, even part of the year, to me it's like a non-starter. So that's
like, it's like distilling outside in Florida.
Yeah, exactly. that's incredible that it's that long. Yeah, I think probably because of map distortions. I can go on a whole tangent on this, but it's kind of like the maps you see where Africa and Greenland are the same size.
Yeah. Yeah.
When in reality, Africa is seven times the size of Greenland, but that's because the map distortion, it's off. So, I had the idea that New Zealand was much smaller. Yeah. But an 18-hour driving, that's just for the one island. I think
it's a big country with 5 million people. So that's plenty of room in New Zealand.
Yeah. And I think also the image of New Zealand that most of us have is probably of the South Island. I had to guess, just because for better or worse, the immediate image of New Zealand that I think of is like Lord of the Rings scene play kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm a huge fan of that. But that's, again, like you were saying, the Alps, the mountains, the cold, more desolate kind of thing, as opposed to a subtropical.
Yeah.
So in terms of what we've seen in film, in popular culture, etc. I feel like the South is probably a little bit more represented than the North.
Yeah, I'd agree. You know, there's fantastic scenery all over New Zealand. And, you know, if you look at, you say you're a Lord of the Rings, etc. fan, etc. and the rest of it, Hobbiton's in the North Island. So the kind of rolling green hills, etc. and the rest of it. And then you're down to the South Island. So there's massive, magnificent kind of mountain river shots and stuff like that.
Right. That makes sense. One day I will get there. One day
you'll jump on that 19-hour flight and
yes. you know, it'll be like a 2-month thing. Of course, I have to include Australia, New Zealand. I want to get to Japan. I've got to do the whole Pacific Rim at some point.
Yeah.
But that is a trip to come. Back to Pocono. So you were focusing mainly on Pocono, but just to bring it back just a little bit, you mentioned you had history in the whiskey industry.
Yeah.
So you're not starting from scratch per se, sort of knowledge wise, when you created this new distillery. With the relative lack of New Zealand distilleries, I think it would be fair to even put in just South Asian distilleries and Oceania distilleries. What setup or what did you look for in terms of inspiration for your distillery when you were thinking about both design and what kind of spirit you wanted to create?
Yeah, so I think, you know, as you say, I was fortunate that I have been in the industry for kind of 26 years. So we had a pretty clear idea of what we wanted to do. So we had a clear vision as well of trying to put New Zealand on the map as a kind of single malt producing nation. So we kind of scaled the distillery straight away to size that it would be able to develop a global brand. We also decided that we were going to only focus on single malt whiskey. So there were no white spirits, no founders casks, no contract distilling, nothing like that. And I think, you know, we and this is more my personal preferences, that I mean, I personally love my smooth and sweet whiskers. It's something that I'm just a personal fan of. So that was the profile that I was always going to try and make. So I think we had a clear idea of kind of, you know, what we wanted to do from a scalability point of view, what we wanted to do from a volume point of view, how we wanted to build a brand over a 10-year plan. And we had a pretty clear idea of what sort of whiskey we wanted to make. So after, it was all about kind of selecting and designing the equipment and the distillery to be able to deliver what we wanted to do. Probably made us, you know, do a lot more of a bigger upfront investment than we probably wanted to originally to actually get there. But yeah, it makes our life easier further down the track.
And forgive me, this is an impertinent question, and feel free to tell that you can't answer. But I was watching one of the very few interviews that I was able to find, it was on NBR.
NBR, yeah.
And you're saying, on that, it was a $10 million investment upfront, really, just to build, yeah, to fill the casks and bring them to those 3 years without putting out any of the, as you're saying, other products beforehand.
Yeah.
Was this from, you know, outside investors, personal investment?
Yeah, no, we have fully financed the distillery ourselves. So today it was something that we went into, and we said, you know, clear vision. We're a family owned business. We want to be a family owned business. So we've put all the funding in ourselves, kind of thing, to make sure that we're masters of our own destiny as well. It's the whole ethos behind Pulkenau was, for me, it's a passion project. It's a culmination of kind of 25 or 26 years in the industry. And for me, it's all about making the best single malt we possibly can with no compromise in anything we do. And that's the clear thing that's written on the wall here. There is no compromise in anything we do at any single part of the process. And that's kind of in everything. You know, it was essential for us that we had control of the distillery and that it'd be fully family owned. So yeah, so it's myself and my wife own the distillery, and it will stay that way as well, which is protecting the future.
That's excellent. It's a rare thing to be able to do, and it's certainly admirable. So the next logical step then is you have the investment, you're creating the distillery. You want to create a single malt distillery, a global brand.
Yep.
And there have to be certain guidelines. Now,
yes.
I know, I think on the website, you know, you mentioned that you basically followed the SWA, the Scottish Whiskey Association, the Scotch Whiskey Association, rather, guidelines for whiskey.
Yes and no.
What can be called whiskey.
Yes and no. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And no. And I think it would. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
No. I was just curious if New Zealand had any regulations like that in place. But also, what you were going to answer as well. So go ahead.
Yeah. I think for us, there's the underlying thing which is really key for me is that we are not making a Scotch whiskey in New Zealand. And that for me was from the start, is that, you know, I'm owning it. We're making a New World whiskey. We're making a Kiwi whiskey. And so, you know, I'm very proud of our country, our heritage, etc. Both myself and my wife are New Zealand citizens now. And we're very proud of our home here. So for us, it wasn't about taking inspiration from the past. We're kind of going, no, we're building our story from today, and we are doing things a little bit differently than which we'll get into as well further down the track. As far as kind of, you know, rules and groundwork is concerned, when we started the distillery, there wasn't any. And it was actually quite challenging to build a distillery in a country which doesn't have infrastructure and legislation, because it's actually more difficult when there aren't rules, because you're not quite sure what you should do. If you've got rules to follow, it kind of makes it easier. So we did a lot of work with the authorities over here to kind of work out what they would be expecting for the future industry, et cetera, and the rest of it. And as far as the guidelines for making single malt whiskey, there were no guidelines at all. You could literally distill whiskey, put it in a barrel for a day, and put it into a bottle if you wanted to in New Zealand. That obviously wasn't feasible and able to keep going. So what we basically did is with a small group of distillers over here, we've written some guidelines. That's not legislation at the moment. It's obviously going to take time to put that in. But we're very much following the Australian model. So it's going to be a minimum of 2 years in cask. It has to be bottled, distilled, so bottled, distilled in New Zealand, so there's gonna be no bulk supply outside the country. We are specifying copper pot stills as well to make sure that there's respect for the tradition on that side. And the only thing we're kind of doing things a bit differently is that we're not specifying oak casks. Yeah, we want to leave a little bit of freedom around the wood at the same time as well. There's some fantastic other woods that is possible to look at, so we'll leave a little bit of Kiwi ingenuity in there to allow us to do some different stuff. So that's kind of being worked on at the moment to find a path through to legislation. But everybody who's making whiskey in New Zealand today is following those rules and doing it properly, which is really cool.
That brings up kind of two questions in my mind. The first one being, one I was going to ask later was that if you're following the to a certain extent, if you're following the SWA in any way, you know, how do you adapt that to the New Zealand climate, especially the North Island, which basically just answered, we'll get into a little bit more too. But the other thing I do want to ask about is that you're not specifying the oak casks.
Yeah.
And the reason that piqued my interest right away was, we're hopefully going to be getting some American single malt regulations in the next year.
Yeah.
The last I heard, the estimate was going to be over the summer of 2023. Here's hoping. But one of the rules rather that was put in as a suggestion was, they decided on, it has to be oak, but it doesn't have to be new oak.
Okay.
Everything else in American whiskey other than corn, corn whiskey can be used. Blended whiskey can be used. But American single malt hadn't gone either way. So they're saying you can use new, used, a blend of both, whatever you'd like, as long as it is oak. Anything else has to be considered a finishing.
Okay.
Instead. So it was just something that definitely piqued my interest. And are there kind of native New Zealand or even New Zealand and Australian? I know it's not proper necessarily to lump them both together automatically, so my apologies in advance for doing that, but are there quote unquote other local woods that make good barrels?
There are, and so that's kind of part of our story as well. So it's all part of the kind of, I'll probably take a step back and then answer that question as I move forward. Kind of thing. But so as part of the no compromise in anything we do kind of thing is that we've got everything on site. So we obviously mash, we distill, we mature. To my disgust almost, we also bottle as well, something I didn't want to do. we are doing bottling on site. So we've built our own kind of filtration units and bottling plant, etc. And there's been no coopering in New Zealand for 30 years now, which is a bit crazy with the wine industry, etc., and the rest of it. So as part of our kind of no compromise, as my wife would say, doing everything to its full, is that we've built a cooperage as well. So we actually have New Zealand's only fully functioning cooperage at the distillery, with a master cooper who's been with us for 5 months now. We brought him over from Scotland. So we have the ability at the distillery to not only repair, rejar, dechar, we can also build our own casks from scratch as well, which is cool. And we have actually started doing that as well. So we've started experimenting with some native wood. We've built our first casks. There is spirit sitting in there at the moment. It's very recent. There's a number of native woods that we're looking at. I mean, we're very much at the experimental side today. I mean, nobody's ever made casks out of this wood. So it's kind of one, it's can you actually bend it? That was the first challenge. Can you actually bend it? Once you've made it into a cask, will it leak or won't it leak? Is it porous? Isn't it porous? What will it do to the spirit? Now we've obviously done some tests on, on with various woods with New Make spirit in the past to see, not in casks, but to 3, 6 months maturation to see how spirit will adapt. And we've got a good idea of a few native casks that will work very, very well. But yeah, it's for us, it's a really exciting project. It's something which is different. It's something which is going to set New Zealand apart as well. So we're excited. That's a really exciting project for us.
And this is jumping way ahead, but as you, particularly as you explored other casks, let's say non-oak casks, do you foresee any difficulty as you're growing into this global brand to attract people to alternative woods or get over that initial, oh, it's not an oak kind of barrier? Do you anticipate that barrier at all?
I don't think there'll be a barrier. I think the consumer today is really interested in provenance and is looking for exciting new stuff kind of thing. And I think, if we can bring new flavors to what we're doing, I think it's great. And at the end of the day, think about there's been so much finishing going on for years and years and years, whether it's sherry casks, rum casks, etc., the rest of it, where we're continuously looking for new ways of adding flavors to the whiskies, etc. I think that the fact that you've got actual different woods bringing different intriguing, interesting flavors, I think it's going to be cool. So, and we'll see when we bring it out. But I can see actually people being really interested. I hope they are. Hope they are. We are.
And I hope they are too. The only comparison I can think of at the moment that's kind of recent to me is I try to. It was a Japanese whiskey, and I use that term loosely because I don't know if it was actually from Japan. Like the whiskey itself was from
Okay.
Japan, but it was finished for, or it was aged rather, full 6 years in Sakura casks, so cherry wood casks. And it was amazing to me because the only other Sakura finished whiskey I'd had was, it was finished for 6 months and it wasn't in a full cask. It was like only the heads were cherry wood and it was so overwhelming. But this had been aged 6 years in a full cask made of all cherry wood. And it was actually quite well balanced. It was remarkable. So that's kind of an exception right now, but I do hope that there's, like you said, that there's more exploration, and I hope that that barrier doesn't exist. I hope that provenance question keeps being asked and pushed for sure.
And I think it's something as well. I think it's interesting that, if anybody's going to bring these new things and new flavors to the table, I think it's New World Whiskey that's going to do that. Obviously within Scotland, there's a framework that is very, very narrow kind of thing. And it's it is what it is kind of thing. But I think with leaving that little bit more of freedom to the New World Whiskies, it's great. It allows us to experiment a bit and bring new flavors to the consumer, which is cool.
I mean, even in America, our regulations are pretty strict. I mean, bourbon as a product is one of the most regulated agricultural and food and drink products in the country, in terms of what you have to follow. So, but luckily, it gives the rest of the world a ton of ex-bourbon casks to use. So, there is an upside.
That's it.
So, yeah, I was fortunate because of our sponsored partner, Impex Beverages. There'll be a mid-roll, I think, after I say this. Just thanking them and about what they're doing this particular month. I was able to sample three of Pocono's whiskeys before this interview. So I got to talk to
Fantastic.
try the Origin, which is the bourbon casks, Discovery, which is first fill bourbon and sherry, and then the double bourbon single cask. And this is jumping ahead too, because usually we go through the process first and all of that. But I really wanted to just jump ahead to say that these whiskeys are remarkably full-bodied, flavorful, very tropical. And I, as I was tasting them, the first thing that hit me was just it flows out of glass. I taste things out of Glencairns, so it's consistent across the board. And some whiskeys have a very tight nose. And these, as soon as I poured them out of the bottles, they're just flowing out of the glass. And I was reminded of the like a New Zealand white wine that's they're discernible because they've got the, you know, the higher proofs in terms of the world of wine, 16%, 15, 16%. Yep. But there's also that characteristic kind of passion fruit note that I get in them. And as I was tasting your whiskeys, I was getting the same feeling, this very lush, tropical kind of feeling of it, of course, which is, of course, helped by the bourbon barrels and yep. all of that with lactones. But it was... The Bar Cart Co-op is a group of five shows with something for everyone. First up is My Whiskey Den, hosted by Mike Lisak, Pat Bologna, and Mitch Weddle. Listen and watch live on Mondays at 9 for thoughts and discussions on craft spirits and, once in a while, some downright odd things. And yes, I'm talking about the cantaloupe liqueur that I can't believe could be good, yet I gotta admit, it's fantastic. Next up is Bourbon Turntable, hosted by Kevin Rose and Drew Crawley. Kevin and Drew are true lovers of both music and bourbon, and I got to join them to talk about my own whiskey and music journey back in March. It's still one of my favorite episodes I've ever been a part of, and it's a show that I listen to every single week. The next two are from a guy you may have heard of. After all, he's a two-time guest on the Whiskey Ring podcast. Mr. Alan Bishop, head alchemist at Spirits of French Lick and self-proclaimed reviver of the history of Indiana's Black Forest. Alan has two shows in the co-op, both of which are also weekly listens for me. The first one is Distillers Talk with co-host Christy Atkinson. It's probably the nerdiest spirits podcast I know of, and that's including my own, and I absolutely love it. Some weeks you'll be talking and capturing wild yeast in long-gone ghost distilleries in the Black Forest region. Others you'll be hearing from some of the most exciting up-and-comers in the distilling, brewing, and overall spirits-producing industry. Most of these distilleries he's gone, I've never even heard of them before the episode, but after listening, all I want to do is find out more and explore new ways of looking at spirits and all the nerdy stuff that I love about this industry. And last but certainly not least is Alan's other podcast, If You Have Ghosts, You Have Everything. Exploring the paranormal side of Hoosier-occupied Kentucky, Alan intertwines his own experiences with stories about neighbors, colleagues, and local legends, and why you should never go into the forest alone at night. Part scary story, part homage to the rich history of Southern Indiana, this show comes straight from Alan's heart and soul. Take a listen or watch to any of these amazing shows, and thank you to the Bar Cart Co-op community for welcoming me. Join the community on Facebook, follow on Instagram and YouTube, and you'll have another show for every day of the week. A single malt that clearly had its own provenance, its own, if you want to use the word terroir and yep. place, sense of place, which you use that phrase in the NBR interview, and I've been using that because of Dave Broom's book. That's probably the reason I was most excited for this interview was to talk about that part of it. So as of now, we're recording in February 2023. We're just starting to get distribution here in the US, but we'll be building. And that's good. And I really hope I can grab a couple of bottles and get people to try it because it's new. And I like new and interesting. So that was a long soliloquy. So to get those flavors and the mouthfeel that you're getting on the whiskeys, a lot of that must be attributed to the locality that you're in, the valley, the water. So jumping back into that, as you're going through getting the barley, getting the barley, germinating, then milling and mashing, then fermenting. Take us through that process.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So we use 100% New Zealand barley. So it's grown in the north of the South Island in a region called Canterbury, close to Christchurch. That's the area that's most of the cereals in New Zealand are grown. It's obviously drier, better than the subtropical North Island for growing cereal. The barley strain that we use is Laureate. And then it's malted for us by a company called Malt Europe in the South and North Island. They malt it to our specifications, and they'll deliver up to the distillery. We batch distill at the distillery, so we kind of, we've got a batch process where we use 550 kilos of barley at a time. We've got a half ton mash tun, so it'll be 2,700 liters of wort, 3,000 liter fermenters, We have a 3,800 litre wash still, a 3,400 litre spirit still. We've oversized the spirit still, so it allows us to do two wash distillations for a spirit distillation. What we do, as I mentioned earlier, in as far as the process is concerned, is that we've really slowed everything down. I knew what type of whiskey I wanted to make. So you know, on the wash, when we do the mashing, we'll do a very long recirculation of the wort to get that wort as clear as we possibly can. All of our spirit, all of our process times, all of our transfers are done very, very slowly. So we'll transfer from the wash tun from the mash tun to the fermenters very slowly. We do a slow fermentation, so we'll ferment for 80 hours. Obviously, the primary fermentation is done in about 39. We'll double that, and we'll get a nice secondary fermentation coming through to develop some of those floral passion fruit notes that you can take in the whiskey. We'll then do a slow transfer to the wash still. Our beer is coming out about 8.9% alcohol. The wash distillation is a traditional wash distillation. It will take us about 6 hours to do a wash run. From the 2,700 litres of wash going in there, we'll get about 900 litres of low wines. So we obviously do a double wash distillation, so we'll distill another ferment as well. So we'll end up with 1,800 litres of low wines, which we'll load in with our 800 litres or so of four shots and faints. But then the main difference is in the spirit still that we distill incredibly, incredibly slowly. And we also distill quite warm as well. So obviously I'm looking for a green grassy, a sweet, a smooth, a fatty mouthfeel on my whiskey. And one of the key things for that is slow distillation. So we put an incredibly small amount of steam onto the stills. We've actually had to put in a special piece of kit called an Ogden pump. And that Ogden pump comes and blows condensate out my coils for me, because otherwise I'm distilling so slowly, I'd end up with having a steam hammer, which obviously is the last thing I want. We do get a bit of surging in the spirit still, especially the start of the run, but that's because we're putting so little steam on to distill so slowly. Our distillation rate's about 2.5 to 3 liters per minute, which is crazy slow. I mean, most distillers will be sitting at 10 to 15 liters per minute. What that means is that we're basically, by this slow distillation, we're obviously the condensate struggling to rise, it's falling back down, it's struggling to rise, it's falling, we're refluxing continuously in the still, and what that reflux is doing is increasing the contact with the copper and sweetening and smoothing my whiskey at the same time. It's probably situating me somewhere between a double and a triple distillation, because normally after a double distillation, you'll be taking your spirit up to about 68% alcohol, and then you'll be collecting down to about 62. We start our collection at 77, and we stop our collection at 72. So we're probably somewhere between that double and triple distillation, just because the time we're spending in the still, the reflux, and pushing the ABV up. What we're doing as well is we're running a very, very short cut. So we will run on four shots for about 40 minutes. Again, that's a long time, because I'm trying to burn off those heavier alcohols, etc., and the rest of it. And out of what is an extremely long spirit run, because of the speed we're going at, our spirit run will last between 8 and 8.5 hours. We'll be on spirit for an hour and 50 minutes max. So it's kind of all through the process, it's slowing things down and doing things a little bit differently. It gets back to that no compromise in any part of the process. The idea in making, let's make that new make drinkable before it goes into the barrel, rather than using the barrel to hide a multitude of sins. That's the kind of the ethos of what we're trying to do.
Absolutely. And certainly the kind of fattiness as you use, I think it's a good word for it, just a very buttery without being greasy.
Yeah.
Kind of mouthfeel to it. And it's also a very apt thing of being between a double and a triple distillation.
Yeah.
You get the mouthfeel and the heft of a double with the cleanliness of a triple.
Yeah. So, and I think you've got as well what's really cool, and you know, some of that's coming from the fermentation, some is coming from the water, I think, as well. But we're getting, you mentioned passion fruit before, but I think what really distinguishes as well is some cool citrus notes. I mean, on our new make, we've got these cool notes of grapefruit, pithy grapefruit that kind of come through. We're going, that's really cool. And like you say, it's that tropical feel to the new make, which I think is sets us aside. And as you said, gives us provenance. And I think the comparison with some of the New Zealand wines is really good.
I mean, that grapefruit note, and as the pithy, especially grapefruit note, was something that I picked up immediately. It was like the first scent out of the glass. Yeah. And yeah. We're to be clear too, we're talking sweet, like a pink or red grapefruit, not the type that your grandparents eat or like just makes you pucker just looking at it. No, something really sweet. And like when you take citrus peel and you candy it, and it still has that little bit of pith on there. So you still get a little bitterness, but it's mainly candied in syrup or sugar, whatever it may be. And interestingly, over the three products, I think the double bourbon and the origin, which is the bourbon cask, those two were closer in terms of profile. And then the discovery being a little bit different, but each had a different element of that grapefruit and citrus going between, again, like a pink grapefruit to a Meyer lemon or a pink lemon, something like that. Very sweet, not overly tart, just tart enough to know that it's acidic.
That's really interesting you say that, and it's really good to hear, because when we put all the products together, that for me that really is the profile of our new make. And I didn't want to over dominate that with anything. So even when we're talking about Discovery, which is our sherry influence product, and I do say influence product, we still wanted those citrus notes to be present in different ways, but we wanted them to be present. So it's really cool that you say that. It's great.
For the to go a little bit deeper on that, for the Discovery, what kind of sherry casks were you using?
So we used for the, so I might take again, I'm playing around here, but I might take a step back again before I get onto that and talk about the maturations. I think that leads into that quite well, kind of thing. So, as far as the maturation is concerned, really the climate that we have is crazy down here. I mean, when we built the kind of distillery, we were kind of going, yeah, New Zealand subtropical, it's going to mature quicker. Obviously, it's going to mature quicker. So we kind of built the business plan going, you know, well, it's probably twice as quick as Scotland, 3-4% a year evaporation rates. That would be pretty good, kind of thing. We'll get a quick maturation. It'll be cool. When we started emptying the first barrels after 3 years to check the spirit and see what it was like, we're going, oh, that one must have leaked. Oh, that one must have leaked as well. You get to the 10th barrel and you go, did they all leak? Yeah, what's going on here, kind of thing. Our evaporation rate is sitting at 9% a year. It's absolutely nuts. So, you know, after three and a half years, I've lost 30% of my barrel. It'd take me 15 years to do that in Scotland. So I think, you know, clearly we're looking at this maturation as rates going. On one side, we're going, oh, the business plan, we might have to change it a little bit. The second thing was we're getting these fantastic whiskies after three and a half years. But what was really apparent to me in the whiskies is that if you take a whiskey that has spent a long time in an oak barrel, for example, you know, gradually those most new makes are very vibrant and fruit when they start, kind of thing. But a lot of that vibrancy in the fruit has been kind of diluted over the 10 or 12 years it's sat in an oak cask, and the vanilla, the wood has started to take over those soft oak notes, etc., and the rest of it. I think because we are spending such a short time in barrel, you know, 3.5-4 years, we're getting the smoothness from the quick maturation, but we're not losing those vibrant fruit notes. I think that's true with a lot of the New World whiskies. They're very fruit forward, and I think that characterizes kind of New World against Old World, is that we've got the vibrant fruit forward whiskies in the New World and the softer oak tannins coming in the Old World whiskies. I think is really cool as well.
Yeah, I could see that divergence for sure. And I'm just thinking of the so one of the recent interviews was with John Campbell, now at Lockley Distillery in Scotland. And he was saying that, I'm not going to remember his words exactly, but basically, you know, he's planning for not just the 3-year distillate that's coming out now, 3-year age distillate in the new first editions, but for the 10-year, the 15, the 25-year versions of these things down the line. Now, obviously, that doesn't seem like that's really an option for you. So,
it'll be a very expensive 10-year-old when I get there.
Exactly. I have a little syrup in the bottom.
New Zealand years are like dog years. You have to multiply by 5.
Right. So, as you're starting to really empty these at a larger rate, and I know you're in the experimental phase still, but you're also putting out a solid, more than solid products as well. Yeah. Are you already seeing any signs of overaging or overcasking?
It's interesting because we bottled quite a lot of product last year. And this year we've kind of been checking our older spirits, sitting at about 4.5 years old at the moment. And we're looking at the 4.5 year old spirit, and it's definitely lost a little bit of that vibrancy. So I think we are going to get to the point where we're kind of going, we might not want to take this much further, or if we are, it's more of an experiment than anything else, or actually, do we have to go into second fill barrels for longer maturation? But yeah, as we were saying earlier on, you know, the kind of evaporation rates that we've got, our 10, 12 year olds are going to be the equivalent of, you know, the top end, extremely old whiskies in other parts of the world kind of thing, because we're going to get very small volumes out there, even if we do decide to age that long.
Sure. And there are similarities there with, I'm thinking it's kind of the same in evaporation rates, but complete opposite in humidity, but Santa Fe spirits and also Whiskey Del Bac in New Zealand, New Mexico and Arizona respectively, you know, they're getting about an 11% angel share a year, but Santa Fe's got almost zero humidity. So yeah, they're putting out product at about a year and a half, 2 years old. That's ready to drink, tastes great because it's just aging that much faster.
We were finding that as well. We were finding that kind of a year and a half, the whiskey was more than drinkable kind of thing. But I think we've waited. I mean, we could have released earlier, kind of before the three, if we wanted to, especially in areas like New Zealand, Australia. We decided to wait until we really thought we were hitting the product profile that we did. And that 3.5-4 years for us, I think, really is that sweet spot. Which I think at the moment is, we're really enjoying the spirit of that age. It's going to be interesting to see how it does evolve to an older age. But I'm not convinced that, you know, we are wanting to push it a long way past that. It's again, crystal ball, but I'm not convinced that we do. We'll see.
Sure. I mean, likely with those evaporation rates, you're probably right. It's going to be what it's going to be. And at a younger age rather than a later age, we'll probably hit its peak. I can think of, like, I'm just thinking there's one exception in American whiskey, which is kind of, for me, rye. Like, you can have a really good young rye. You can also have a really great rye at about 6 to 7 years old. And then for me, at least after 7 to 8 years old, it really dips. And I don't like those ryes between like 9 to 13, 14 years old. And then suddenly at 15, granted, you got to get there and have enough distillate to get there. But at about 15, it suddenly just starts to gain this whole new character. Like, it's getting a second wind. Granted, with lower evaporation rates, which with much longer aging processes. But I'm just curious, this, as you said, it's crystal ball. I'm curious to see if that would happen if you just kind of let it go.
It's crystal ball. And we decided, I mean, it was really, really important for ourselves. That, as you know, mentioned before, the Origin, you know, which is our lead product, is 100% first fill bourbon cask. We didn't want to hide the profile of the spirit behind other casks. It was really all this care and attention that we've taken over making our new make. We wanted to showcase that out. And just really let that profile shine through. And I think, the quick maturation we're having just really shows through in that. But that vibrance of the fruit stays there. Well. We only do first fill bourbon casks. That's all we do. And to be honest with you, we take so much out of that first fill bourbon on the first maturation that it would be, I think, pretty used for the second one. So as soon as we've used them once, we then move them off to sell them to breweries, other distilleries, etc., and the rest of it. We only use the cask once again. That's part that no compromise thing in everything we do.
And I think this was either in that MBR interview or one other one. Again, like I said, this is one of the very first interviews you guys are doing.
I think this is the third one I've done. I think the second or third one I've done. So.
Exactly. So this is kind of breaking news for listeners here. But I think you said you got the ex-bourbon or ex-American whiskey from Brown-Forman, Jack Daniels.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we've worked with them for many, many years. So we take those.
They're popping up a lot in a lot of places, and that's not a bad thing at all. They're putting out a lot, so they've got plenty of barrels. I'm thinking too. When you're getting the barrels, first part of the question is: do you get them imported whole and then rebuild?
Yes, we do.
You do, okay. Because you have the cooperage, so you're one of the rare people who could actually. You know,
we could, I think, as well. It's a There's only so much coopering that kind of at the moment we've got a cooperage, a one-man cooperage, so there's only so much coopering he can do. And I think for us, it's obviously he's pressure testing the barrels, repairing them when they arrive to get them fit for fill, etc. And that's key for us. And we want to focus very much the coopering on building our own barrels as well. And also obviously STR casks, et cetera, and the rest, which is something that we kind of started working on at the moment as well, but New Zealand STR casks. So.
Gotcha. So the second part then is you're getting them whole. So like, how long does it take to get those barrels to you? And by the time they get to you, are you looking at a pretty dry barrel? Like, is there, I feel like there's no such thing as a wet fill when you're getting from Tennessee to New Zealand.
Yeah. It's no, there's nothing, but it's the same thing in Scotland. I mean, how long does it take to get from the US to Scotland? I think it's not actually too bad. It would take us 5 weeks to get the barrels. It's a direct route from Kentucky into Auckland. So they get here. I mean, they gets here. We check every barrel. We recoup them if necessary. Pressure test them, etc. And then it's pretty good to fill. But anything in New Zealand takes ages to get here. I mean, there's very little stuff in New Zealand. You can't buy corks. You can't buy capsules. You can't buy glass bottles. You can't buy everything's coming in from overseas. So you definitely have to plan things in advance.
This month's Impec Spotlight is on Pokeno Whiskey. Sitting just south of Auckland on the North Island of New Zealand, Pokeno is one of the Pacific Rim's newest distilleries. Founded by whiskey industry veteran Matt Johns, Pokeno set out to create a uniquely New Zealand single malt whiskey, one that would bring the lush, subtropical terroir into the world's most recognizable category of malt spirit. I've been able to try their origin and their discovery series, as well as a single barrel, double matured and ex-bourbon, and each were truly fantastic. And in case you're wondering whether I really do get to try these things that I talk about, or whether I even like them, I'm here to tell you yes to both. If I don't like it, I don't have to talk about it. And I can't stop talking about Pokeno to anyone who will listen. As of March 2023, Pokeno is just starting to come out into the US market with a rapidly growing footprint. I sometimes say that there are distilleries to watch. This is one to watch while sipping their already world-class single malts. Check out my episode with Matt and Pokeno in late March, and order your bottle of Pokeno New Zealand Single Malt today. Hey, Whiskey Ringers. I hope you've been taking advantage of that podcast-only code for the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society. They've got around 20 bottlings coming out each month, and there's never a shortage of new things to explore. To take advantage of this podcast-only offer, please go to smwsa.com, that's Scotch Malt Whiskey Society of America, and put in code WRP for Whiskey Ring Podcast at checkout for 25% off your first year subscription. And as you're, because you're so heavily dependent on, really entirely dependent on import for anything other than the very local agricultural products that you have, how did you manage the last couple of years with COVID and with glass shortages and all of that, just as you were getting ready to bottle your first spirit?
I chose probably the worst year to launch a whiskey brand in, which was 2022, because we were right at where everything was most difficult, especially in New Zealand, because we kind of lived COVID a year after you guys. We'd kind of shut ourselves off and we were free for the year. Everybody else was locked up, and then we were locked up a year later, kind of thing. So it was pretty difficult. It was all about anticipation. I mean, we to be absolutely honest, I had built in a 12-month buffer to everything, to receiving glass, to receiving dry goods, to receiving everything for the launch. We received the last dry goods 2 weeks before bottling. So that 12-month buffer had been completely used. And if we hadn't done that, we would have been the launch wouldn't have happened. So it was kind of, it was frantic. There was a lot of ducking and diving and frantic phone calls and calling in favors and stuff like that. But we kind of got there. We got there in the end. And that continues. I mean, we have to anticipate 9 or 12 months in advance. Yeah, everything coming into the country. We've got some fantastic partners, whether it being on the glass, the corks, the capsules, etc. And we just work very closely with them to make sure that we can get that in time.
I don't envy you. I can't imagine the number of sleepless nights you had in those just before that 2 week period. Oh, God. Oh, actually, you know, I missed one of my questions. Just jumping back a little bit to the stills, and I do this very often on my interviews. Sometimes there'll be another thing that I forget. So, on your website, there are pictures of the stills and it's part of the video intro to it as well. And you mentioned that the sizes of the stills before the 3,800 liter and 3,400 liter wash and spirit still. The line arms on both stills are nearly horizontal, at least by the picture.
Yeah, probably. So the line arm on the wash still is inclined downwards slightly.
Okay.
And the wash and the line arm on the spirit still is upwards. It's actually quite a decent uphill, just because we're trying to encourage that reflux, make it even more difficult to go. So that it might not look like that on the photo, but the wash is down and the spirit still goes up.
Gotcha. Okay. I mean that still makes sense. But yeah, I was looking and I was like, that's remarkably, you know, even plain. But that makes more sense. Yeah. And those stills were, as I said in the interview, one of the few things imported from Scotland, from Macmillan.
Yeah.
And were those based on any other previous design or design from scratch?
Well, there's only so much you can do with stills that size. I mean, our aim was to make them as tall as we possibly could, because obviously we're trying to make a sweet and smooth whiskey. So we're very much accentuated on we wanted the snot swan neck and we wanted the tall stills. After that, there's only so much you can do on stills that size as far as shape and form is concerned. So they're kind of quite a traditional kind of swan neck still. But yeah, I'd say that the height to given the volume of the stills, they are quite high.
Gotcha.
I can say the tallest stills in New Zealand for the time being, but there's not many stills in New Zealand.
No one needs to know that second part. You could just say the highest one.
We've got the tallest stills in New Zealand. There you go.
Yeah, that's what. So, you know, all this comes through in the whiskeys, the house style, in both flavor and feeling, the climate as well, and just the tropical sense of it. I think you get the tropical notes from the flavors, but also somehow from the environment. So those all come through. And so I think you also get a little bit less evaporation just because there's less airflow.
Can you imagine how much evaporation would go if they were racked?
Exactly. Yeah. by having them packed so tightly together, you get less airflow. So hopefully less evaporation. Must be a beautiful microclimate in between those barrels though.
It is. It's nice. It's in a hot day, we kind of go and hide out in the middle and just have a chat in the middle of the barrel room. It's quite nice. Yeah. We rack a small amount of casks, but mainly just for kind of, we keep an eye on the maturation for sampling for different types of casks, etc. Obviously when you're palletized, we're palletized 6 high as well. So it's quite high. So once they're up there, you don't really want to be pulling them down every month.
Well, for sure. And with it being palletized as well, thinking of the best way to phrase this one too. With it being palletized and the capacity you've got now, the other option that in theory, could be done would be to do dunnage style.
Yeah.
But correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like that wouldn't really be an option since you're basically, you're in a valley, but you're basically at sea level.
Yeah.
So was dunnage ever a consideration?
No, it wasn't something that we kind of looked at. I think as well, because the ratio of the land and the space, et cetera, and the rest of it. I mean, today we're sitting on a kind of 5,000 square meter site. Which we've still got half of to develop. So we've got plenty of room for further warehousing, et cetera, and the rest of it. But it was more looking at utilization of the site as well.
So with the bringing the subtropical climate that you're then dealing with, what are the outsides of these warehouses look like?
They're, to make it even worse, they're black. So we've basically, I mean, we've got we've gone for ours is a traditional kind of, if you use traditional with New Zealand whiskey, New World whiskey, but we've gone for a working distillery. We're not necessarily a beautiful distillery in a lovely landscape against the Lord of the Rings hills, etc., and the rest of it. So we're a couple of big black steel buildings. Which inside we spent all our money on the inside of the distillery, not the outside of the distillery, about making the good whiskey. So big black steel sheds goes well with our branding, with our kind of silver and copper branding up on the outside of the buildings. People aren't really sure from the outside what goes on inside, apart from all the stacks of barrels by the cooperage.
Sure, for sure. With the subtropical climate, are you pretty much at the same kind of climate throughout the year? Or is there any variation therein?
Yeah, it does change. I mean, we will, you know, we're supposed to be in summer at the moment. I'm looking out the door, it's raining, so obviously we're not. But, you know, during the summer, we'll go from 20 to 30 degrees kind of thing. But the New Zealand sun is brutal. You know, 20 degrees over here feels like 40 degrees in Europe. There's big holes in the ozone layer just above New Zealand. Crazy levels of humidity during the winter. It's wet and humid. It doesn't get cold. It never gets cold. I mean, the coldest we will get here is maybe 10, 12 degrees centigrade. Obviously talking centigrade, not Fahrenheit. And it will go up to kind of 18, 20 even during the winter. So, you know, I've lived in New Zealand for 13 years. I've still not put a coat on since I've been here. It never gets cold, but we do get those variations in humidity and temperature.
Gotcha. I'm assuming the warehouses are just kind of let to... Yeah. Be what the weather will be.
People have asked me, people have said to me, why don't you temperature control them if you're getting so much evaporation? I'm kind of going, well, no, because I'm making Pocono whiskey. If I start temperature controlling, I'm no longer making Pocono whiskey. I've just got to let it go. So we just, it's all part of the game and let it roll.
It's good. I mean, not that you have to run by me, but that's certainly good with me. It makes sense. You said you have about half the space on site left over. What are your kind of grand plans for the next phase? Growth.
I think, you know, we at the moment we've got four fermenters at the moment. So our only roadblock for increasing the volume is the number of fermenters we've got. The mash tun and the stills can do as much as we want. At the moment we don't need the volume. I mean, we're not even running at capacity now. We're probably distilling about 75,000 to 80,000 liters of pure alcohol a year. But we're only distilling for ourselves. We're not doing any founders cask, contact distilling, etc. We're just growing the brand. So we'll probably carry on at this rate for another year or two. We've got a theoretical capacity of around 100,000 to 120,000 liters of pure alcohol at the moment. By adding an additional six fermenters, we'll take ourselves to 250,000. So we'll probably do that expansion in 2024, I'm thinking. 24, end of 24, 25. And at that point in time, more capacity, we're going to need more warehousing, another warehouse, and then we'll need more room and build some offices, and then it just kind of runs on. It's never ending.
It really is. I mean, and more people. Because you, more people, more than one cooper.
More than one cooper, a few apprentices.
Right. And because you're not necessarily aging this stuff for more than 3 to 4 years at a time, it's not like you're having... I think a problem is not the right word, but the thing that, like Kentuckians have, where they have these huge warehouses and that are the stuff sitting there for 7, 8, 10, 12 years. Yeah. So they need more space constantly, but you're able to kind of turn those barrels around much quicker.
We're turning the barrels around. I think there's a number of problems, but a number of things that we deal with is that we're turning the barrels around quickly, which means that all the barrels need to be quite accessible. So we can't be hiding, back for 10, 12 years, et cetera, and the rest of it. We're increasing our distillation every year. So even though we're emptying, we are increasing the distillation, but also we're only using the barrels once. So we've got a big volume of barrels that we're moving on as well, because we're emptying those. And if you're using first fill, second fill, third fill, fourth fill, you're amortizing your barrel over four fills. We're amortizing it over one. So again, it's just that barrel management and cask management as well.
It's fascinating. I think we've run through all of my questions, which is somewhat of a rarity for me, because I rarely don't talk that much. So
I didn't answer your sherry question properly. I'll answer
oh, that's true. Yes. So for the discovery, what do you mean by sherry influenced, and what kind of sherry are you using?
Okay, so what we do on the maturation is that I don't do a massive amount of finishing, just because I find that it's quite difficult to always kind of, especially when you're having products you call range, to hit that same profile time and time again with finishing. It's kind of a little bit of an inexact science. So what we do is we tend to fill into all of our barrels from day one. So I'll go new make into bourbon, new make into sherry, new make into virgin, new make into wine, etc., and the rest of it. That will give me lots of different ingredients to make up my different whiskies after a full maturation. So what we do then is we make up our whiskies, but we then fill them back into cask. And we fill them back into cask to marry together perfectly for 3 months before bottling. Again, that's part of that no compromise thing. I also fill them back into the same casks I've emptied. So if I've emptied, you know, PX Oloroso and First Fill for discovery, I then fill the vatting back into the same PX Oloroso and First Fill. So I'm not trying to influence it anymore. I'm just trying to marry it together. So to go on to discovery, what we've done with discovery is there is a percentage of whiskey aged in First Fill bourbon barrels, a high percentage. And then there's a percentage of whiskey aged in PX and a percentage of whiskey aged in Oloroso. The reason we started at the start looking at just one of the sherries, playing around with either PX and Oloroso, I wasn't getting the layers of complexity that I was looking for. So then we started playing around with them both, and playing around with the kind of percentages a little bit. There's actually a pretty even split between Oloroso and PX we ended up at. And I just find that those kind of savory notes, they'll also kind of counterbalance a little bit the overpowering PX. But again, we weren't looking to overpower the citrus notes. So again, we were trying to come up with a kind of result at the end, which still allowed that citrus to shine through, which it kind of sounds like we've just about managed to do from what you were saying, which was, yeah, that was the kind of ethos behind that one.
Makes sense. I guess with that, I mean, what else, just to close out the idea of, I mean, this is the first time we're going to Oceania, let alone to New Zealand. So, have we missed anything about what's going on in New Zealand today with not only Pokeno, but just on the islands in terms of distilling?
Yeah, I mean, there's some real cool stuff going on. I mean, we're still at the birth of distilling in New Zealand. If you put the whole industry together, the distillation capacity, it would probably be the size of a small distillery in Scotland. So there's a long way to go. And Pokeno is the largest distillery in the country, but there's some real cool guys doing some cool stuff. You know, if you think about, you know, Cardrona, Thompson Whiskies, Waiheke, we're just building a distillery at the moment. There's a small team of passionate kind of distillers, old distillery down in the South Island as well. There's some guys doing some real cool stuff. And the cool thing is that everybody's working together to further the industry and to do things properly. And for me, that's really important. So, and the more people that come on board making the whiskey properly, the better. It's going to help us develop that category overseas, which is really, really cool.
And that brings me back to, and this will be, I think, my closing question, which is, you mentioned that, just make sure, that Thompson's had been the first of the kind of new wave of distilleries here. So when you're, and that's in like 2012, 2013, when you're designing both in your mind and on paper, the distillery, did you talk to Thompson's and be like, you know, what are some very obvious potholes that I need to avoid? And
Matt and I are good friends, so we have been for a long, long time, kind of thing. So everybody is kind of going down their own road. Everybody has their own kind of character as well, which is great. Everybody likes different things in their whiskies, so there's kind of a lot of variety going on in New Zealand, which is great. Matt's got his own house style as well, which is very, very cool. I think it's kind of, everybody's doing their own thing, everybody's building their own story, but together collectively we're also trying to build New Zealand's story, which is great.
Wonderful. I think that is a perfect place to end. And so, Matt, thank you so much for taking the time for again one of the first interviews. I'm excited, and
it's been a pleasure.
It's a rare thing for me to be able to do this, so thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I will be talking up these whiskeys. There will also be, you know, reviews, tasting notes to come out with the episode, as always. There will also be links to your social media, to the Pokeno website.
Please tag us on social media as well. It'd be great. We'll tag back, or however that works. I'm not very good at that kind of stuff.
All good, all good. So hang on with me for just a second after recording, then I'll let you go. It's been another episode of the Whiskering Podcast. Please, if you can, on your favorite podcast app of choice, leave a 5-star rating review. If you got any feedback, feel free to hit me up at david@whiskeymyweddingring.com or comment and I'll find it somehow. And thanks for listening. Tell your friends and I'll see you next week. Hey folks, thanks for listening to another episode of the Whiskering Podcast. If you like what you hear, please go ahead and click that subscribe, follow, or like button. Leave a rating and review on your podcast app of choice, and let me know what you want to hear. You can reach out to me through the podcast apps or email me at david@whiskeymyweddingring.com with any suggestions or ideas for new show guests. You can also support the podcast at patreon.com/whiskeyinmyweddingring. That's whiskey with an E, for as little as $1 a month. $5 a month gets you access to bonus content, including our soon-to-resume Under the Influencer series, and $25 a month means you join the Barrel Share Club. Each month, Barrel Share Club members get to try products sent to me for review, bottles from my own collection, and sometimes bottles that I just pick up because they're fun or interesting. Right now, only 5 spots remain in the Barrel Share Club, so grab your place today. Finally, please follow on Instagram. You can follow me at @whiskeymyweddingring or at @whiskeringpodcast. You can follow me on Twitter at @whiskering. You can follow on Facebook at Whiskey My Wedding Ring or join the Facebook group, the Whiskey Ringers group. And I hope to see you there. Cheers. Thank you for the support and see you next time.